active shooter. It's not a drill.
As we speak, there is a horrific scene playing out at a high school in South Florida.
At the moment, we have a white male, we're told, wearing a burgundy shirt.
She kept texting me. All she kept saying was, please call 911. So I did. Told her, I love you. Please stay safe.
I thought I was going to die.
17, you know, casualties, 17 people that aren't going to return to their families. And to me, that's totally unacceptable.
I'm still just shaking a bit because, I mean, that's my baby sister, you know.
We cannot be complacent. For anybody who's been paying attention over the last couple of years, I think if we've learned nothing else, we've learned that this can happen anywhere.
1 year ago today, 17 lives taken, dreams shattered, families devastated.
And I'm pissed, because my daughter I'm not going to see again. She's not here. She's in King David Cemetery. That's where I go to see my kid now. We can't forget about it. All these school shootings, it doesn't make sense.
Soon after, a new movement was born.
Not one more!
We're excited. It's cold outside, but it's okay because it is for a good cause.
We just want change.
Enough is enough!
Enough is enough!
Enough is enough!
This cannot be the America that we all accept.
Senator Rubio, can you tell me right now that you will not accept a single donation from the NRA?
All these people should be at home grieving, but instead we are up here standing together because if all our government and president can do is send thoughts and prayers, then it's time for victims to be the change that we need to see.
But in the year that followed, roughly 1,200 children lost their lives in the United States due to gun violence. That's the equivalent of a Parkland shooting every 5 days.
There are children all over the country dying silently because no one picks up their stories. No one collectively chronicles what happened since Parkland.
And so a project was born to remedy those holes in media coverage and public dialogue. And it was driven by teen journalists.
Every day he told his mom, "Mommy, you're so pretty. I love you. You're the best mom in the world."
A small superhero, loving and affectionate.
His mother proudly called him his sister's protector.
Known for being affectionate, he freely offered hugs and kisses.
4-year-old Kymarley Michael Harrington accidentally shot himself after finding a .40 caliber handgun in his Oakdale, Louisiana home.
Demetrius Micho Jefferson, 4, accidentally shot himself in the head at his family's apartment in Richmond, Virginia, while his mother slept in the other room.
Voices for the voiceless. I'm Arun Roth, and this is The Takeaway. Mary Claire Molloy is a student journalist. She's 18 years old and attends Brebeuf Jesuit High School in Indianapolis, Indiana. And Scarlett Liriano-Sapine is a 19-year-old student journalist at Baruch College here in New York City. They were reading there from profiles they wrote for the Since Parkland Project, which launched this week, supported by the Miami Herald, The Trace, and McClatchy newspapers. More than 200 student journalists from across the country wrote profiles for the project of each and every one of those 1,200 children. Mary Claire, Scarlett, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your work.
Thanks so much for having us. We're excited to be here.
Thank you. It's a great opportunity.
So we'll start off with Mary Claire. Could you tell us why you took on this project?
For me, Since Parkland was an opportunity to research and better understand the issue of gun violence, everyday gun violence specifically. But I also believe that telling these kids' stories is one of the most powerful things I will ever do because they aren't here anymore to share what happened in their lives, not just how they died, but who they were. And so being the writer that does that for them is so powerful.
Now, was there some kind of aha moment when you realized that mass shootings like Parkland weren't really the whole story?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of what we write is just everyday violence. And it's kind of like really shocking when you realize it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to get past, you know?
Yeah, so I actually wrote a profile for a 1-year-old girl from Indianapolis. She only lived a few miles away from me. Her name is Malaysia Robson, and I had no idea that in March of 2018, two men shot over 44 bullets into her home, and one struck her in the chest and killed her. And I had no idea this had happened in my own city. And that opened my eyes to everyday gun violence and the idea that there are children all over the country dying kind of almost like silently because no one picks up their stories. No one collectively chronicles what happened until since Parkland.
Yeah. It's kind of like we've become so desensitized to this everyday gun violence. So when it happens, it doesn't really get as much coverage as it should.
Scarlett, was there a particular story that, I mean, I know there's it's maybe hard to pick one, but that stuck out to you, like maybe especially from when you first started?
I mean, definitely when the kids were on the younger side, like we write from the ages of like 0 to like 18. So I got a bunch of kids that were just like 4 and 3 years old. It was incredibly heartbreaking. Mm. Yeah.
And for both of you, you talked about this a little bit, but could you talk a bit more about what you felt your responsibility was to these individuals and their stories?
I mean, we are here to tell the stories of our fallen peers because they can't tell those stories anymore. I would say what makes Since Parkland so powerful is that we are of the age of some of these kids. Hmm. We are part of their generation, and so we are chronicling the fallen kids from our own generation, and that is so powerful. There's a level of relatability there that if you had adult writers doing these profiles, I don't think you would get that. I don't think it would be as powerful.
Both of you, tell me about some of the reaction you've heard from people so far to the profiles.
We've gotten all sorts of reactions. A lot of people are super impacted by it. We've gotten parents who have lost children to gun violence. We've gotten just all sorts of people just thanking us for our work and acknowledging it.
I had a Sandy Hook mom. She lost her daughter in Sandy Hook. She tweeted me that she was so sorry anyone ever had to write these profiles, but that they were amazing, something on the lines of that. There's been several moments through writing Since Parkland where the permanence of death has really struck me. Hmm. And that was one of them because her 6 or 7 year old daughter never got to grow up, and she has to live with that for the rest of her life. And likewise, there was a moment when I was writing profiles about halfway through the project when I realized these kids are dead. They're not coming back. And they seem so vibrant and alive when you're writing about them because you're searching for the things that make them unique and wonderful. And then you still have to wrestle with the fact that they're gone.
You know, I know as a journalist, which is what you both are, when you spend a lot of time with stories like this, you know, that deal with violence or tragedy, it can get to you. Did it ever feel like too much or get to you emotionally?
Yeah, I would say we have a group chat of all the kids writing profiles. So we try to kind of create a little bit of a sense of community, especially for some of the more like violent. Well, they're all violent, but some of the harder ones to write about when there was, for example, I was one of 3 journalists who wrote about 3 kids who were killed by their father. One was a 9-month-old who I wrote about. One was a 2-year-old, one was a 4-year-old, and a 5-year-old was involved too, but they didn't die. So the father put them all in his SUV and shot them all and then turned the gun on himself. But to write that piece was really haunting, and we connected together, shared research, talked with each other about the process and how we were feeling, and I think that really helped us keep going.
I have to think that you must both be thinking differently, or when you hear the news, the idea of gun violence must affect you differently than it did in the past.
Yeah, I would say that it's a lot more personal. We're never going to see victims of gun violence as statistics again. It's so much more personal when you know the stories, when you've seen the faces of the children in front of the trigger. It changes your whole connection to the issue.
Have your views about gun violence changed from a policy perspective or a political perspective?
The biggest policy stance anyone in this country should take is that 1,200 kids shouldn't die from gun violence. We're not going to tell anyone how that should be solved, but it's just a call to action that it should be solved and that it's all hands on deck. Bring your perspectives to the table and do something. That's really, we want to bring individual readers to their own conclusion that this gun violence must stop. And we want to encourage them in any way they think is possible or good to stop the death.
Yeah, it's about raising awareness and making people conscious of the fact that this is happening.
You know, it's kind of, there's kind of an implicit criticism in this project of the media, of the mainstream news media, that we are not doing a good job of telling these stories. So I'm going to ask you both to sort of play media critic, you know, some months, you know, a year in now. Is the media doing a better job with a story, or are we still missing stuff?
I would say that while researching this project, I discovered which victims would get coverage and what that coverage would be like. Oftentimes, victims who are white had so much more coverage than victims of color. And victims of color, in terms of what I discovered with my writing, were more likely to be left unnamed in an original report, and you would have to go find their name. I also think that the media, both locally and nationally, report a lot about the death of the child and the perpetrator instead of who the child was. I can think back to all the mass shootings I've, you know, watched or learned about while I was going to school. Sandy Hook, for example. And I never remembered the victims' names. I always knew the perpetrators' names. It was only till Parkland that I knew all of the victims' names. And that needs to change, and that we are talking about the lives lost and not just how they were lost, but who the person was before.
In research, oftentimes we would have to work past news articles that have already been made. And a lot of the times there wasn't much to work with. We would have to like research really in depth to even find names or places where it happened. It was kind of heartbreaking.
And you talked about the response a bit, but this must have meant so much to the families.
I think so. I've seen a few tweets from family members of victims. I think they're still grieving. They're always going to be grieving, but this is just a powerful moment for them to see their lost loved one chronicled in a really, really powerful way.
Mary Claire Malloy is a student journalist at Brebeuf Jesuit High School in Indianapolis, Indiana. And Scarlett Liriano-Sapin is a student journalist at Baruch College in New York City. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
And you can find the profiles of all 1,200 children, including those written by Mary Claire and Scarlett, at sinceparkland.org. Now we turn to the lasting effects that children who survive gun violence and other traumatic experiences face. According to the National Survey of Children's Exposure to Violence from a decade ago, nearly half of children and teens in the U.S. had been assaulted in the last year. 1 in 10 were physically or emotionally assaulted. 1 in 16 were sexually abused. Many children experience trauma on a host of different levels. That trauma can come into sharp relief in a school setting, damaging relationships, and the ability to learn. Now there are increasing efforts to take trauma into account in the classroom. Here to talk with us about how trauma has impacted behavior and academics in schools in Rochester, New York, are Paul Clark and Nalika Murray Fields of the Center for Youth Services. Welcome to you both.
How are you?
How are you?
Good, thank you. Those are some pretty awful statistics that I just went through. How does exposure to violence or abuse affect children and teens in school?
Oh, it affects them tremendously. They bring in these struggles that they have in the community into school. And for our young people, especially at the elementary school level, they really don't have the skills and the know-how to control those feelings.
Let's be clear. When we're talking about trauma, what exactly are we talking about?
So trauma has so many faces. So we have young people that trauma may look like a house fire and they may have just lost everything they own. Mm-hmm. We have trauma that looks like I'm removed from the family. It may be I have a sibling that's incarcerated or a family member, a parent even. We also have kids that are just exposed to violence, whether it's abuse in the home or they're witnessing it out. So it has so many faces and so many ages and is expressed in so many different ways in our young people.
Rochester is one of a few school districts in the country that are taking a trauma-informed approach to teaching. Nalika, you do this work day to day and day in and day out in a school. What does that look like, you know, actually there in the school?
It looks many different ways in the school. It may be students just running out of class, walking out of class, having explosions where they're cursing and angry, and some kids get really withdrawn. So that's why it's great to have an adult in the building so that kids have a safe place to come and talk and just kind of process some of the things that they're going through, a lot of which come from outside of the school that is just brought in because that's where they go 5 days a week.
You have them process this not just verbally, but physically, right?
Absolutely. So we incorporate a lot of fidget toys because, you know, they're anxious. Maybe they just need to fidget. It's extremely tough conversations for kids to go through, and they're trying to match verbally these feelings with words, and sometimes that's just a great way to do it. We do a lot of restorative circles to process it and have restorative conversations as well.
Can you give us an example of an individual who experienced some kind of trauma and then how you were able to use these tools to reach them and reach the trauma?
So last week, I mean, I feel like we deal with this all the time, but last week we had a fifth grader and he was removed from home and kept running out of class throughout the day saying that his mom was coming to see him. He was in foster care. That was not the case, but he was just running in and out of the classroom just thinking that, hey, mom is coming. So the best thing to do as opposed to trying to force a child into an academic setting that they're obviously not prepared to be in is for them to come down and we have a conversation about how are you feeling? How is this affecting you? And we give them a voice. What do you want to see happen right now? How can we support you? So those are the kind of questions we process. And then also, if skills are necessary, then we talk about, okay, so I know you're upset or you're feeling frustrated. What are some ways that we can kind of channel it in a positive way? And we kind of talk to the kids, give them a voice, and have him kind of figure out what is going to work for me. For that particular child, he just needed breaks to walk throughout the day. So that's what we did to support him.
Paul, do we have any sense, any numbers yet to tell us if there's been a reduction in violence in Rochester schools?
We definitely do. We work in a number of schools within the Rochester City School District. We're in about 21 of those schools. One school in particular that is a kindergarten through eighth grade school has the supports in the school that what we call a social-emotional support continuum. So we have staff from the Center for Youth in conjunction and collaboration with the Rochester City School District that provides services from 7 in the morning to 7 at night. But in this particular school, and I'll give you a comparison from last year to this year. Last year, at this time, there was 154 short-term suspensions out of school. Currently, this year, there's only 32. Last year, there was 12 long-term suspensions, so that's a pretty serious offense to be suspended more than 5 days. Currently, this year, there's absolutely none. So it does work. But again, this is relationship-based. This is trauma-informed care, restorative practices, and it works.
I'm wondering, in terms of getting this sort of system in place in other places, what are the obstacles? What's in the way of getting this out in schools all over the place?
One of the biggest ones is right now is the funding. And with many of the school districts' budgets being looked at very carefully and slashed universally through New York State, there is a funding issue. However, we as a community agency cannot rely solely on school districts to fund this type of service. So I'm speaking for the Center for Youth. We want to make sure that our young people are getting these services, and we will look at other funding streams in order to bring this service to school districts.
And I also think the other part of it, too, is as you know, in Rochester, especially the Rochester City School District, graduation rates are really, really important. So sometimes we're competing for those school hours. And, you know, kids who are in trauma, it's hard to learn. So we're trying to kind of walk this balancing act, trying to figure out, hey, do we remove them from class for this socio-emotional need that needs to be met? Do we leave them in class? What does that look like? So I think that's one of the day-to-day things that we try and figure out, what is best for this child in this moment? Do they need to be in the academic setting? Or is it, are they not going to be able to learn? Do we need to have them come and sit with a caring adult?
Paul Nalika, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Paul Clark and Nalika Murray-Fields of the Center for Youth Services in Rochester, New York.
Hey, you, podcast person, Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.
Four, three, two, main engine start, zero, and liftoff of the Delta rocket with Opportunity, a chance to explore and unlock the secrets of our neighboring planet.
On July 7th, 2003, NASA launched the Opportunity rover into space. It landed with a bounce on the Martian surface thanks to a weird but effective airbag system. Opportunity's three-month mission, to explore the Martian surface for evidence of water. That mission lasted more than 15 years until this week.
I'm standing here with a sense of deep appreciation and gratitude that I declare the Opportunity mission as complete.
That's Thomas Zurbuchen, an associate administrator at NASA, speaking Wednesday at a press conference marking the end of Opportunity's journey. To learn more about Opportunity's accomplishments, I spoke with Moya McTeer, an astronomer and PhD candidate at Columbia University.
So Opportunity was launched in 2003, landed on Mars in 2004, lasted for 14 years, which was incredible, until there was a really bad dust storm on Mars in June of 2018. And so really the last message we received from Opportunity was back then saying, hey, there's this dust storm coming. It's getting really dark. I'm probably not going to be able to recharge my solar panels.
So that was Opportunity saying goodbye in a way?
In a way, yeah. I mean, it never really got the chance to say a formal goodbye. Not that it would have. It's a robot. But that was its last signal back to Earth.
Now, you mentioned how Opportunity's original mission was only 3 months, and it was able to keep going for 15 years.
Yeah.
How?
Amazing, brilliant engineers on the team really held it together. NASA launched Opportunity in 2003 when we were relatively new to launching things into space. And putting that 90-day mission duration out there, I think they were trying to be really conservative. But now we know more about how missions on Mars actually go, and we usually expect missions to last much longer than 90 days. The last rover to be launched was Curiosity, which was launched in 2011, and it was supposed to last for 2 years, right? I mean, of course, it's lasted more than seven at this point, but I think we're getting better at coming up with realistic estimates for mission durations.
To give a sense of how long ago that was, Opportunity landed before Twitter, and now Opportunity is on Twitter with about 500,000 followers. So in those 15 years, can you talk a bit more about how Opportunity added to our knowledge of the planet of Mars, how it changed our knowledge of it?
So its original mission, its primary mission, was to study the rocks and soil on Mars, on the surface of Mars, to find minerals that might indicate that Mars once had water. And we're really interested in water because it's a sign that the planet could have once hosted life. And so Opportunity found a lot of minerals that are usually associated with water in different craters on Mars. So it found hematite, which mostly forms here on Earth in the presence of water. It found gypsum veins on the surface in the Endeavour crater. That's really cool because gypsum forms when rocks crack from water flowing through them underneath the surface. And opportunity found clays that typically form in water that has a neutral pH. So that's really exciting because, you know, you can find water, but if it's acidic, that means that life probably isn't going to form around it. It's really important to have neutral water for the formation and sustainability of life.
Now, even as we mourn the loss of opportunity, or OPI, as aficionados call it, there's still plenty of research being done on Mars actively right now. Bring us up to what NASA is focusing on right this moment.
Yeah, so right now the only rover left is Curiosity, which is going strong and has had a lot of amazing discoveries just in the last year. So I remember last year there was that finding of organic molecules on Mars. There was methane found in the surface and in the atmosphere of Mars, and more evidence that water once existed on the surface. So that's just on the surface of Mars, but we also have spacecraft and telescopes here on Earth that are studying Mars's atmosphere, studying how it will react to particles from the sun in the solar wind that's constantly bombarding the inner planets. Yeah, so we're always collecting data on Mars. It's never going to stop.
Moya McTeer is an astronomer and PhD candidate at Columbia University. Moya, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Amazon today announced it has decided not to proceed with plans to build a new headquarters in Long Island City, Queens. This comes after months of intense backlash to the move. WNYC's Jim O'Grady is here to tell us what we know about how this decision came to be. Jim, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Arun.
So, why did Amazon change course?
This is the one question I can't answer. we don't know the deep reasons, but we know what has led up to it. The opposition that you mentioned, it's come from many quarters. It was led by two politicians in particular, State Senator Michael Gennaris and Queen City Councilman Jimmy Van Bramer. They said they didn't like the deal. The deal was up to $3 billion in government subsidies to bring Amazon here in exchange for 25,000 to 45,000 jobs. They thought that was too generous of a package to a trillion-dollar corporation and the world's richest man. And also citizens groups. You know, I was at a city council hearing a couple of weeks ago, and an anti-Amazon banner was unfurled from the balcony and interrupted the hearings. A group went out over this past weekend and knocked on doors in Northeast Queens to just speak to homeowners one-to-one, saying, this is not going to be good for your neighborhood. Prices are going to go up. There's going to be displacement and gentrification. So that sort of has been the face of opposition to Amazon in New York City.
So a lot of people seemed really surprised by this. How do we know how this decision was made ultimately? I mean, obviously, as you said, you don't have a special line to Jeff Bezos, but
What I'm thinking about it right now. Amazon is so big, they can do whatever they want. They don't care about hurting our feelings or upending our plans.
We thought so until today.
They said they were going to move here. All kinds of plans were made in conjunction with that. And now, with almost no notice, they've pulled out of those plans. So I spoke to someone at the New York City Economic Development Council whose job was to woo Amazon, bring them around. He coordinated all the meetings, all the site visits, all the setup for this. And the first word he said to me was devastated. What is this going to do to New York? He said this would have diversified our economy by bringing in a major employer. Amazon has 5,000 jobs here already, and they say they'll continue to grow here, but they are not going to be a major employer. He said all the executives at a high level who make decisions about exciting R&D projects, collaborations with other industries, they're all not going to be in New York now. They're going to be in Virginia and Seattle, most likely. So in his view, New York City is losing a lot by losing Amazon.
Well, the city did say no in the end. Is there going to be fallout for those politicians who came together to support this? We're talking about, you know, Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo.
Great question. I was at the Queensbridge Houses, the largest public housing development in America. It's right near what would have been the Amazon site. And I spoke to tenant advocates, and they were all in favor of the deal. They were salivating at those jobs for their people. Also, an independent poll by Siena College came out yesterday showing around New York State 20% approval rating for the Amazon deal over disapproval. So yeah, so I imagine that some of these people will have questions for those politicians who were key to bringing down this deal. But they should also have questions for Amazon itself. Hmm. They did the thing. They made the decision. They decided they couldn't take the heat, so they got out of the kitchen. They're the ones who should be answering questions. We've tried to ask them. They haven't talked to us so far.
Jim O'Grady is a reporter for WNYC. Jim, thank you.
Thank you, Arun.
We close out this Valentine's Day with a story of unexpected love. Nishtha Mehra grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, a daughter of Indian immigrants who had an arranged marriage. In adulthood, Nishtha fell in love with a white woman, one who didn't initially want children, but they ultimately adopted an African-American baby, creating, as she calls it, her brown, white, black family. Mixed-race families and interracial couples are more common than ever in the U.S. In 2015, the Pew Research Center reported 1 in 6 newlyweds married someone of a different race. It's true of my parents and of me. Nishtha wrote about her experiences in a new memoir called Brown, White, Black, An American Family at the Intersection of Race, Gender, Sexuality, and Religion.
I fell in love in a very unexpected way. I was a freshman in college, and I walked into an Introduction to World Religions class and was captivated by one of the professors who was teaching the class. And that was sort of the beginning of the rest of my life, as it were. It was not what I was expecting. It was not what she was expecting. And I think because it was so surprising and so powerful for both of us and for all of the people in our life who were also very surprised, I think it really set the stage for us to have an understanding of love being something that pushed us outside of our boundaries and pushed our imagination a little bit outside of the conventional and what we might have sort of thought things would look like, and to be open to things looking very differently and to be pleasantly surprised, I think, by what can be possible when we sort of let go of our own plans for what our lives will look like. And that's certainly been a theme for us in the almost 17 years that we've been together.
You have to forgive me for asking like mushy romantic questions, but did you have a sense right away that she was the one?
I did, and it's so embarrassing because I'm not that kind of person, you know, quote unquote. I definitely thought of myself as being sort of this like hardened realist in a lot of ways, and had determined that I always admired Jo March from Little Women, and I had determined that I was going to be sort of, you know, a late bloomer, as it were, and it was going to take a while to find the person, and I had sort of kind of decided that was going to be how it went, and then I got hit by this train of just being completely captivated by this human and having to adjust my life accordingly. So I did end up with sort of my older professor, but she's in a very different package than what I had imagined.
And let's talk about how your family then expanded, how the love expanded, because that's also sort of an expected but unexpected tale.
It is very much so. And I think one thing that's funny that we can joke about now is that Jill checks all these boxes that sort of the immigrant aunties and uncles really want, just not in, again, in the container that they thought, right? She's very smart. She cares about her family. She is has a philosophy and a PhD in philosophy of religion. So she knows probably more about Hinduism than I do, right? So she's sort of all of these things. She likes spicy food. She's from Louisiana, so she can totally handle the heat. She just isn't what we necessarily thought I would be bringing home. But to their credit, the community that I grew up with, they have been wonderfully welcoming and warm. And it is just beyond my wildest dreams. It was definitely a journey. It was a long road. And my father didn't live really long enough for us to reckon with that in a way that I think we probably would have eventually gotten to. But, you know, I was 23 when he died, and he just wasn't there yet. So my mom is still with us and has really demonstrated for me what it can look like to have flexibility and to be open and to change your mind about things. And I think that that is really humbling for me and also really powerful, given that a lot of folks are sort of in a place where they remain convinced that they have sort of the one view of things. And my mom has demonstrated that you can see things differently over time.
Well, let's get back to the thing that I know your mom, not to stereotype Indians, but knowing my own family, they're going to want a grandkid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep, that was a big piece. I think that was part of their fear and worry was, is this still going to happen? So that was always on the table for me. I always knew that I wanted to be a parent. With Jill, it was a little bit different. So that was a big part of our conversation, too, and our imagining about how our lives might look differently and take some surprising turns now that we were with each other. And so when we applied for adoption, that was obviously a thrilling moment for my mom and also a nerve-wracking one for her, sort of being convinced that it may not go well and worried that it may not go well.
But your partner surprised you with that, though, because she was not thinking that she really wanted to be a parent originally, right?
That's right. It was another sort of really powerful example for me of how people can shift and change and be flexible in their thinking. So we were not in a big hurry. Obviously, we've been together a while. I was pretty young. And after some time and some thinking, it became really powerful for her that this idea that we could open our home to a child who needed one.
Now, you're Indian, South Asian background. Your partner is white, and the child you adopted is black.
That's right. A big part of the conversation for us was when you do apply to adopt, right, there are questions about what you feel comfortable with, what you're open to, everything from potential drug exposure in utero to gender to race. And we had lots of conversations because we wanted to be responsible and wanted to be in reality as much as we could about what it would look like to bring a particular child into our particular family. And when it really came down to it, we could not imagine ever saying no to a child if that child's birth mother said, "We want you to be my child's parents." And so we checked all the boxes on that form and said, we want a baby. And so we were very moved and touched when our child's birth mother matched with us. And we sat down across the table from her and she said, "I want you to be my child's parents."
Did it make things harder or more complicated? Or do you feel like you had kind of a leg up already because you've already navigated so many issues of a multiracial family and relationship?
I think the main thing that we've learned is that people are, what people do with us is really mostly about them. You certainly worry as a parent, I think certainly in the early days, and maybe more so as adoptive parents because your parenting is so visible or it just stands out more in the world that, people are going to judge or what people are going to think or have we made the right choices.
Nish Tamara is the author of Brown, White, Black, An American Family at the Intersection of Race, Gender, Sexuality, and Religion. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I truly enjoyed it. And happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day. Today on Valentine's Day, we also want to hear your love stories. What hurdles did you overcome to find love?
When I was 17 years old, I met my high school sweetheart when I was a senior, and I fell in love with him, and he was a bad boy, and my parents hated him. And after 3 years of dating, when we were 20 years old, we decided to get married, and they were not about it. And they begged me not to marry him. They told me it was a huge mistake. They told me it would never last. And now, 37 years later, we're still together and still in love and have two beautiful kids and have so far so good, lived happily ever after, and I can't imagine anything changing that.
It's been great hearing from you this week. That's all for us today, and for me filling in on the show, it's been a lot of fun. I've had a great time. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Arun Roth. That's R-A-T-H. Tanzina will be back with you on Monday. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Roth, and this is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air.
I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.